Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Fostering Innovation in Underrepresented Groups, presented by Autumn. My name is Holly Lundgren, Autumn's Online Professional Development Manager, and I'll be your staff host for today. All lines have been muted to ensure high-quality audio, and today's session is being recorded. If you have a question for the panelists, we encourage you to use the Q&A feature rather than the chat feature. If you have a technical question or a comment, please do use the chat feature for that. Today's session may be eligible for ethics or professional responsibility CLE units. Throughout the webinar, you will see pop-up surveys that are simply asking for a yes or no answer. If you do not intend to apply for CLE credits, you may simply dismiss the poll. If you do intend to apply for CLE credit, you must answer the question as it is answered. For more information about CLE eligibility for this session or what states have already approved this program, please contact me at hlundgren@autumn.net. I would like to take a brief moment to acknowledge and thank Autumn's 2020 online professional development sponsors. We appreciate the ongoing support. And I will now introduce today's speakers. Cedric DeHue holds a BS in chemistry, an MS in analytical chemistry, a JD in law, and a PhD in analytical chemistry. After spending several years in a large firm, he currently leads his own firm, DeHue Law LLC, where he continues to work as a patent attorney and has obtained over 50 patents. Tanya Zion, JD, is a strategic business and growth consultant, professional services executive coach, and speaker. Her advice is sought after by attorneys, business owners, and team leaders seeking out professional and business development, resulting in optimal performance and accelerated growth. Isabella Ortiz is an invention associate at Northwestern University, Office of Innovation and New Ventures. She manages a wide portfolio of engineering and medical device technology. Her work consists of developing an IP strategy to execute various licensing deals for the technologies. At this time, I'm going to turn it over to our distinguished speakers. Welcome, Cedric, Isabella, and Tanya.
Oh, thank you so much, Holly, and I truly appreciate this opportunity to talk about a subject that is pretty near and dear to my heart here. So thank you all for coming and participating as well. So today, as mentioned, we're going to be discussing the Success Act of 2018. We're also going to be talking about the USPTO Success Act report to Congress of 2019, as well as some of the actions that the USPTO is either, you know, taking or proposing to take. And then I'll be turning the presentation over to Isabella to go on with the rest of the presentation. Well, as an attorney, I do have to make a disclaimer. You know, I am an attorney. I may not be your attorney. I may be your attorney, but just me giving you this presentation does not make me your attorney. That out of the way. So we wanted to talk about the purpose of the Success Act of 2018. It's to address a recognized gap in inventorship for women, minorities, as well as those that have veteran status. I'll be talking just pretty generically about the groups as underrepresented groups, unless specified otherwise. And of course, underrepresentation is related to inventorship and not in terms of population. By any stretch of the imagination, as women make up half of the population. So the rationale for the Success Act was that there has been a recognized gap in inventorship between women and men and minorities relative to whites. There were a number of studies that are used to identify and recognize this gap, and they're listed here. I want to make mention now that in the interest of time, I won't be going through all of the slides of this presentation, but this presentation will be made available to you when the recording is sent out tomorrow, and the information associated with these presentations are included as either hyperlinks or and the details of this presentation and the hyperlinks associated with it should be made available. If you have any issues, feel free to contact me and I'll be happy to get you all of the presentation materials as well as these studies. Just to highlight a few of the findings from these studies, this chart identifies in red with the red circles, it identifies the share of patents that have at least one woman inventor. Now, of course, this is not a recognition of parity in that you can have patents that have multiple inventors, but this is only the percentage of patents that have at least one woman as an inventor. And you can see how that difference is. There's a gap between the number of women that have share of degrees in the STEM, all STEM degrees, or in specifically engineering, biological, computer science and such, is significantly greater than the number of patents where there's at least one woman listed as an inventor. Looking particularly at the patents by their classification codes, you could see that, again, there are disparities between the classification codes and the number of patents that list at least one woman as an inventor. What you can see, though, is that the numbers, especially in terms of the life sciences, are quite higher than those in terms of, say, more engineering-heavy classification codes. Alex Bell did a very nice study that used data from a census and was able to get information such as this geographical variation in gender. We also will see how Alex Bell's research in this figure shows that if you correct for parental income and test scores, it accounts for about 50% of the gap between white and black children, the test scores being third grade test scores. But the other 50% of the gap in inventorship is unaccounted for in Alex's and Mr. Bell's research. Now, so far we've talked about the Success Act of 2018 and its recognition of the gap. Dr. Cook, as made mention here, also found that African-Americans are just a little less likely than whites to commercialize their inventions. So the return here is that if we are able to minimize this gap in inventorship for underrepresented groups, we should see an increase in commercialization and innovation, right? Because as more underrepresented groups patent, they should commercialize their inventions at similar rates than others. Okay, so we've kind of laid out the 2018 Success Act. It's already law, it's already in place. And then part of that Success Act law was a requirement to the USPTO to provide a report to Congress within a year. And so in October of 2019, the USPTO provided the report to Congress, and the report had these three portions to it. We've already talked through a lot of the first bullet point, the identification of publicly available information about women, minorities, and veterans, and the benefits associated with increasing those numbers. So there's no need to go through that again. Of course, the report does talk about that in a bit more detail. But there's also mention in the report of the USPTO's existing programs, as well as proposed additional programs and initiatives that are supposed to be relevant in closing the gap. So we'll be talking about that next, and then we'll follow up with legislative recommendations that the USPTO made to Congress on how to encourage and increase participation by underrepresented groups. Here's a list of the existing programs and initiatives that the USPTO made mention of in their report of 2019. It'll be interesting to see how these existing programs and initiatives are, whether they're effective or not to mitigate this or to alleviate or minimize this inventorship gap. Right now, as we'll talk about later in the legislative portion, the USPTO doesn't collect demographic information. And so it's hard right now to look at these programs and initiatives and say whether or not they're actually helpful in minimizing this gap. So the USPTO also makes mention of a number of initiatives, things that they would like to do going forward to try to address this gap. The first being the IP toolkit. It's really a great opportunity for Autumn to have a pat on the back to state that the USPTO 2018 report makes mention of the inventorship rate for women in particular and states that it is significantly higher and consistently increasing when you look at inventions that come from universities, hospitals, and other research organizations, and that some of the lowest participation rates for women are in corporations. And so USPTO is definitely committed to creating an IP toolkit to address those areas, but Autumn should definitely take a pat on the back for its work in this area, as recognized by the 2019 report. Also, USPTO, in its 2019 report, recommended the creation of a council for innovation inclusiveness. I'm very pleased to report that this council is already in existence. It's the National Council for Expanding American Innovation, and Autumn has representation on this council already. Stephen Sosolka is a council member, and he is the CEO of Autumn, and Megan Anstus is the part of the working group representative for the council. She's also the chair for the Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Committee. And the council is looking to obtain additional information from the public on this process. So the website is there listed for the council. It takes you to their page on the USPTO site. And there's an opportunity that should come up sometime later this year for federal rulemaking to provide comments and information to the council. So there was a question made earlier before we even gave the presentation about what was the most important aspect to address to increase underrepresented inventorship. And I do think that this council provides that opportunity. You know, it's a living, breathing organization, a group of people who are involved in this process, and information can be provided to them. The legislative recommendations that have been made, if they are promulgated, the council can take that information and evaluate existing programs and, it's the USPTO's other initiatives. So the council really does provide the greatest opportunity, you know, for us to address this current inventorship gap. So thank you so much for the question. Hopefully that gives a good answer. And if you have any additional questions, feel free to contact me later about it. Now, the USPTO also makes reference to a number of outreach opportunities, whether it's to youth and through teachers. It also makes mention of workforce development and training of educators. So all of these are additional programs and initiatives that the USPTO seeks to put forward to try to address this gap. There are a number of legislative recommendations that the USPTO makes as well. These are things that are outside of the scope that the USPTO states that they have now. And so they are making these legislative recommendations to Congress to try to address this gap. Primary here is recommendation number one, is to authorize a mechanism for the USPTO to do a survey, this voluntary confidential biennial survey, to try to understand, you know, as Peter Drucker famously said, if you can't measure it, you can't change it. And so gathering this information is crucial to figure out how the USPTO can address this, you know, our already understood gap. The Andy O'Toole, the chief economist for the USPTO, graciously has provided presentations to both the Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Committee, as well as to the Women Inventors Special Interest Group. And you'll see when you get the presentation, or I can make sure that that's added separately, his presentation materials there. One of the things that came out of his presentations to Autumn is that there are a number of privacy laws, as well as groups that may try to hinder or prevent get collection of demographic information. GDPR comes to mind as an example. And so it would be helpful to have legislative action for the USPTO to have a framework with which to follow on how to obtain this information and to do so in compliance with other laws and rules and regulations. There are also a couple of recommendations made for the USPTO to work with other institutions, such as federal agencies. As made mention earlier, Alex Bell and his study on who becomes an inventor in America did a very good job of providing things such as demographic information. He was able to look at whites versus blacks and children in terms of third grade test scores. And from my understanding, he was able to get this information as part of a process where he's able to get information through the census. And so the USPTO being able to get that same sort of information would benefit them greatly in being able to address the gaps and to figure out best policies. And I definitely would think that the council being able to evaluate this information, it would be very helpful for them to be able to have information from other sources outside of what is gathered from the USPTO alone. There's also mention of federal grant programs, working with other agencies in order to get funding to promote inventorship and entrepreneurship among underrepresented groups. There are a couple of recommendations that are more awareness-based. You'll see that in recommendations 4 and 5. And these are all things that are quite helpful. One of the things that's mentioned in a number of the studies is that prolific underrepresented group inventors are more likely to work with other underrepresented groups in filing additional patent applications, and also more likely to encourage others to file as well. And so being able to have recommendations that deal with awareness, similar to the proposed programs and initiatives that the USPTO is putting forward, would be helpful in that regard. Okay, so what we have is that we had a 2018 Success Act that's been promulgated. We have the report to Congress from October 2019, which we just discussed and talked about. And then we also have additional acts that are pending. We have the IDEA Act, which is still just a bill. Shout out to Schoolhouse Rock. And it is still pending in Congress. And so it provides another avenue under which we can provide information or gather information. And now, while the IDEA Act is very similar to the Success Act in recognition of this gap and in numbers of patents applied by underrepresented groups, the one difference in the IDEA Act is this recognition that the lack of inventorship by underrepresented groups is a hindrance to our economy. That if we had the same inventorship rates in underrepresented groups as we do for others, then we would see an increase in, say, GDP, which is definitely a nice aspect to raise as a benefit to attacking this structural issue. So I think my time is up, and so I'll be passing the presentation on to Isabella Ortiz of Northwestern to talk about the InvoHER program. Isabella?
Hi, thank you, Cedric. Let me share my screen. I think you have to stop sharing.
Yep, there you go.
Perfect. Well, thank you everyone for joining the call or the presentation. Let me get this going. Where's the present? All right. So, what I'll be talking about Northwestern's INVO is a few programs that we have started. And first I'll go into the stats that Cedric kind of went into in the next slide. But for the most part, what we see in Northwestern is women are less likely to disclose inventions than men. They're less likely to patent. They're less likely to engage in entrepreneurial activity, you know, create startups, become leadership positions on different boards. It's something that we've seen, you know, for many, many years, and it's really haven't seen an increase too high. Well, the next slide I'll go into is the, okay, I don't know what's going on. It's gonna be me. How are you still listening? Okay. There you go. So these are the stats that Cedric kind of went into a little more detail, but these are from 2016. There's about 12% of all patents are inventors, or 12% of all patent inventors are women. We really can get into how many are just pure women inventors as opposed to just having at least one woman inventor. As you can see, there's 21% is one inventor is a woman, but it's still pretty low. It's below 50%, and these numbers haven't moved up over the past year. So there's current things that Northwestern we're trying to do to increase this. So here are a few more stats. I won't go into too much detail about them. I know stats can be a little boring sometimes, but as Cedric said, without measuring, you can't really make a difference. But what we see is most of our technology vendors come out of the chemistry and a life science area. There is a smaller percentage of engineering women vendors, which is another layer of innovation that we're trying to conquer, is getting more vendors from all departments and all schools. So here's just a few more stats why we need female vendors. You guys probably already know this, but you know, more diversity, more perspectives, more success. And so what we need to focus on in the university area is getting inclusive organizations just for women, the vendors. A lot of times there's stats have been shown that, you know, most females in leadership positions or successful positions have an army of other women in the same position around them that they talk to every day. This is very important because they have a network of women that they rely on. And so when you deliver a inclusive organization for them, that gives them a bigger community, which I'll talk about in Bohur, a program I created to create a network for women. Success rates are higher with female executives. These stats have been shown. And women entrepreneurs of the century, they have a learning agility. They know how to multitask. They have a lot of things they're taking care of, a lot of hats they're wearing. So it's just overall, we really need female entrepreneurs in the space. So as I mentioned, having a successful network, having a network for successful women is important. So what we're doing here at INVO is a few programs. So the main one is the Propel program from the Garage. The Garage is an undergraduate incubator at Northwestern. Propel has 3 cohorts already. What we've done is we've gotten a group of maybe 20 women in all areas in the graduate program, some of them, but mostly undergrad, that are interested in business. And we take them through a few courses, take them to a trip to New York, introduce them to other executives, and just really teach them how to be an entrepreneur and learn about the environment. From here, they create a program, or in this program, they create a business plan about a potential business they want. And it's a really good program just to teach them. I mean, when you're in your undergrad program, you really don't know much about entrepreneurship. So I think this is a great program. We have 3 cohorts already. And a lot of these women that have been a part of this cohort, they've actually gone off to really great positions afterwards at some great companies and some firms, and even going into a graduate school for business. And so it's really been a positive outcome with this Propel program that we started. Another thing that we're doing is within my office is INVO Reach. And INVO HER is what I'll go into more detail. INVO HER is a community and a network for women entrepreneurs and through all spectrums of their journey. Either they just started a research lab or they are CEO of a company. And so it's a pilot program that we focus on, providing courses, panels, a network. It's still launching. We're still working on it. COVID kind of put a little bit of a pause on a lot of networking events that we wanted to do. So right now we're focusing on interviewing different female vendors and just seeing the perspective that they can provide for women of all areas. Because one thing we've noticed is women like to see women like them. There's a lot of people that aren't featured and, there's always the top women in every university that one knows about, but there's a lot of women that, are in there that don't have a lot of exposure. And as well, research we've shown is that women, they go towards women that are like them, either, culturally, either in the field of science that they're in, any sort of link that they can find with the women, they gravitate towards that. So what we try to do is highlight these women and try to find different things about them. That's not just from their science background, but from, where they grew up, some things they went through trying to get to where they're at. And we've noticed women like to pull to that, and that causes a mentorship for them. So we try to find areas of women's lives that will be able to conversate and connect with others. And so that's why in this program in Bohur, we've created this network and community of women. And from we launched a pilot pitch competition last year. We weren't able to do it this year, but we're running again next year. So we had 7 entrepreneur faculty teams from therapeutics, med, med tech, software, different areas of the medical field. And we had mentors from different investment backgrounds, either they're VC at different firms or they have their own startup. They mentored these 9 women. And it was a very successful pilot program. They had a lot of positive feedback from it. And a lot of these women kept going on to working on their startup or just producing more IP. But that was the reason for this program, was we wanted to increase Northwestern's mentorship in women. It is lower than we want it to be. And luckily, you know, as Cedric said, universities have a higher percentage of inventors women than corporations. So that's good to hear, but it is still low, and it's still something that we still need to work on and focus on. So we're trying different programs like InvoHer. There's going to be a larger one, InvoReach, which is going to focus on different diversity angles, you know, different culture ones, just different ones. But InvoHer was the main one and the first one that we're going to work on. And it did take a lot of work, and it's still taking a lot of work. And I did have a question before this about if this is related to the federal iCorps program. And it's similar, but it's, you know, what we have one of the people part of the program, she's actually getting training on how to be an iCorps mentor. So she's bringing that knowledge into this program. And it's a university small iCorps program mentorship, but it definitely has a lot of similarities to this program. And it's where we guide this off of. So here's a little bit about our efforts. We started the InvoReach Her in 2016, very soft launch, idea conception at this point. And then, you know, 2017, we did the pilot program of doing a few little panels and programs. And then we launched Propel, which I told you about in 2018 with cohort 1, and now we're on cohort 3. And then last year we were able to do the pitch competition. And then this year with InvoHer, we were able to launch a few stories and interviews, and we actually were able to see an increase in the mentorship. It was about a 5 to 10% increase in mentorship this past fiscal year. So here's more activity within Northwestern, as I mentioned before too. So, you know, we have 17% of our vendors are women. And we really can break this down into these are women-only inventions, or if there's a woman on the invention. So these numbers are just having one woman on the invention, and that's a really low number. I'm going to assume the number of women-only inventions is much, much smaller. And so you can see we have a discrepancy with that number, even at the university level. But we have seen a trend of women, like I said, vendors. In 2018, we had it about 20%, went down in 2019. But the last fiscal year, like I said, we were up probably, we're at like 23%. So probably at the highest that we've ever been. So that's good news. It's still lower than I want it to be, but we're working towards that goal. So as I mentioned, we were able to get numbers. So we have 13% of all. Okay, so what I meant by all lead events. So we have the PI on the university inventions, the person that has, you know, as you guys know, the person that owns the lab. So 13% of those are PI women, and then issue patterns, 17% were issued last year, right, by these women PIs. So still, it's a good number, but it still needs to get up there. But those are our numbers in Northwestern. And then this is cross departments. We have Feinberg School of Medicine, FSM. We have McCormick is their engineering department, and we have Weinberg is our chemistry and biology department. Feinberg is the medical school area. So as you can see, there is a low number within the chemistry and biology. The number from McCormick, I will say, is a little off. I think it's based off the low number of people in general that event out of McCormick's. But as you can see there, you know, these are our numbers within our department. And then, but one thing I mentioned, one issue that we did have was engineering faculty members inventing, and that was, we were able to increase that 50%, and this was caused by awareness. We went into the school, engineering school, and just talked about our program, talked about Invo, talked about inventing, really just making them aware of inventing. and what we do and how to protect your invention. And I think this has led to a big increase. A lot of people in the engineering department really didn't know much about patents. And so making awareness was a really big deal. It took a lot of time on our part, but it was definitely worth it with the increase of inventions. And so here's some exclusivity metrics at INVO and Northwestern. So INVO is part of Northwestern, so I'm sorry for the confusion there.
But we have a practicum internship where these students come in and they help us do market analysis and assessments for inventions. So we have 63% of them are women. So that's a really good number. We have a new invention class where it's out of the business school, and where they get an invention from our office and they do a business plan. So about 48% of those women are, or 40% of those people are women in that class. That's really good. And then another entrepreneurship class is 40% of them as well too. So those are good numbers on the student side. And then the startup science and startup competition, which you guys probably all know about, you know, we have Northwestern had two presenters that were women in 2018. We had one woman in 2019. And then three of the five finalists had chosen were women in 2020. So that's a really good uptake for Northwestern and women entrepreneurship. So I won't go into too much detail about this. I already talked to us a little bit, but you know, we have our Info Her faculty mentoring program. You know, we have the Equalize 2020 pitch that happened this summer at WashU. And we had one of our faculty members gave a speech there. And then another thing that we've been working on, and I don't know many universities have done this, we've included a diversity, equity, inclusion section in our license. So what this means that every startup that licenses or company that licenses from us, they have to show some sort of diversity initiative. And this is a requirement in all our licenses now. And we've seen a really great increase in positive reaction from this, where people have to report to us every year what diversity inclusion efforts have they made. And this is a language every time I talk to other universities about, they really like this idea, and they actually never heard about this, and they actually implement it into their own license. So that is definitely something that we see a positive outcome. We have never had someone turn down a license or argue against not putting this into a license. It's always been a very positive feedback on that diversity inclusion section of the license. And that will be it. And I will be sharing the slides with Tanya next. And thank you for your time.
Tanya, you're on mute.
Thank you, Holly.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for all the information that's been shared so far. And I'm going to take the conversation and pivot it to industry and taking what we know about the legal foundations and what's coming out of the academic arena. And then really, what are we looking at in terms of what is industry doing to also help with these initiatives. And I wanted to start with the state of innovation. I have just one slide here that kind of shows what the percent of applications having US assignees by industry. And I thought this was an interesting graphic because it clearly shows that the majority of applications are coming out of the United States. We're definitely leading when it comes to our innovation in the United States. But when we take a look at the same thing and we look at it on our state of diversity, that's where we're continuing to lag in our efforts. And so I'm going to share just a little bit of what the research is and what they're looking at. This is an interesting survey. It was a Trust Radius survey, and it asked people of color in tech, and they broke it up in two different ways. They asked people of color if they think that there are more people of color that are in tech now rather than 10 years ago. And you can see that 65% of the respondents said yes. And then what they did is they asked the same question of white respondents to see if they felt like there were more people of color in tech than 10 years ago. And that survey came back at 58%. And the reason I wanted to start with this perception survey is because I think this is really important, something that we have to overcome in industry and with companies, is really just highlighting the makeup of the organizations. A lot of the tech organizations are very, very large. And so when you talk about shifting percentages of people of color that are in leadership roles, that are in inventive roles, the sheer number of people that you have to bring into the organization to move those percentage bases is quite large. And yet there are a lot of things that industry can do to change the perception, to make the other employees, make leadership aware of the people that they are bringing into the company. And so I think that was an interesting statistic to look at, just as what is the perception. This is a survey 6 years ago. What happened is the big tech companies that you see listed here made a commitment that each year in their annual report, they were going to start reporting on their diversity statistics. And you can see not all the information is in, but I did want to include this because you can see there is an upward trend for the most part in terms of recruiting efforts and hiring efforts to bring more and more diversity into the companies. What I think is also of note is as the larger companies do it, it's an opportunity to start benchmarking against what's working in these companies, to see what's happening, to be able to move the needle forward. This is a similar look, but looking at more of the gender diversity. Again, as the two previous speakers have talked about, gender is moving, it appears, faster than other diversity measures that we're doing. But we are making progress, but you can see the progress is somewhat incremental across the board. So what works? How do we take everything that we've learned from what the law is providing for, what the academic situation is doing, and really bring that into what would be most of our clients? How do we foster innovation, and how do we foster a more diverse workplace? And the interesting answer is they're very similar traits. So if you want to foster an organization that has more innovation, the same tools, the same structure that you need to put in for your teams, your executives, are very, very similar of what you need to be recruiting and promoting diversity as well. The other thing that is quite interesting, and I think both Cedric and Isabella touched on this, is diversity absolutely impacts the bottom line. And across the board, what studies have shown is the more diverse the organization is, the more likely they are to be profitable. So these statistics come from a 2018 McKinsey report. And what they did is they looked at the top companies and divided them into the quartile percentages, looking at ethnic diversity and also at gender diversity. And what they found was the companies that were in the top quartile for ethnic diversity were 33% more likely to have an above average profitability. And I think just from a shareholder standpoint, this is a huge percentage that we need to be leveraging in conversations. We know that diversity leads to better outcomes, more inventive natures, but when the bottom line backs it up as well, it starts to make a compelling case for industry to continue the efforts and to continue pushing forward. When we look at the same results from that report on gender diversity, they were actually 21% more likely to be above average of profitability if they were in the top quartile for gender diversity. So when we think about corporations and we think about what leadership of corporations are tasked with, I think in the past, what we've really looked at is we've looked at, are we turning a dollar into anything more than a dollar, right? How do we make it profitable? How do we return profit for the shareholders? And what we're seeing, and especially in light of current news events, current trending in thinking, is that executive leadership really needs to start taking a broader look at the corporate responsibility of what they need to do for these efforts and how they are not only strategically having conversations from the executive office, but how are they pushing that down and making sure that leaders at all levels are keyed into these efforts from very basic things like meeting agendas, hiring, and how we introduce new hires into our teams. what it's showing across the board is that these things are working, and it's not the major strategic efforts that are there. Those are important, and we're gonna talk about those, but it's really the day-to-day interactions of the employees that really is going to start pushing the needle further and further on these efforts. And when we know that by doing so, it does lead to a greater return for the companies, then it just is a nice little bow on all of this to say, if this isn't a conversation that's happening in the boardroom, you're really missing an opportunity not only to be advancing people that haven't been represented, but also on the profitability. So tactics that we look at that are similar in terms of innovation and diversity. If we want to promote both of these concepts in organization, four key elements kind of boil up to the top. You want to lead from the front. And as I mentioned, top down isn't enough. But if you're not leading from the front, if this isn't what leadership is talking about, then it makes it really hard for frontline managers to make that a priority as well. What we've also learned is culture matters. Companies must make create a safe environment for, frankly, failure. What we found across the board is companies that celebrate failure have better outcomes. We also need to build effective teams, and then again, benchmarking against the best. I want to get into these just a little bit into more of a tactical level, because I think as we're talking with clients, as we're advising clients, as we're thinking about how we're setting up contracts and all of that with the employees, these are the things that we need to be checking and saying, are we including this? And so leading from the front looks like emphasis being on innovation at all levels. One of the things I work with a lot in talking with clients when they're looking to grow is, how clear is your vision? How aligned are all of the aspects of the company on what the outcome needs to be and what we're driving towards within the organization? And I should be able to walk around to anyone in the organization and say, what is your purpose here in this organization? What is your goal for this quarter? And the companies that have a clear vision of that, a clear understanding, and their employees at all levels can answer that question, have better outcomes overall. They can accelerate growth. The other thing to look at is companies must be quick to fail. Anytime we're in an environment of innovation, there needs to be procedures and budget allocation to fail. And that needs to be encouraged among everyone. Because if there isn't this idea that we can fail, then innovation is stifled because people are afraid to act and they're afraid of making a mistake and the consequences of that. When we factor diversity into this, it's even more important that this culture be adopted and have the idea that we really do want to celebrate failure. And the other thing for innovation to work is there's no place for micromanagement. We have to empower our teams and our employees to forge their own path through to be able to do that. And I think with innovation, that's very, very important. And culture matters. And the top two things is the exact same thing in managing the top down. The leadership needs to be creating this culture where we're promoting innovation and we're rewarding failure. Another interesting thing for culture is really utilizing employee assistant plans for reporting. And so typically what the employee assistant plans have been more focused on a mental health aspect or being able to reach out for those type of needs. And there is a trend of utilizing a third party resource through the employee assistant plans to be able to report any incidents that might be related to diversity, discrimination, to be able to do that. And so in my research and preparation for this, it was one thing I came across that I thought was a really inventive idea to be able to create that safe environment of giving employees an outlet to report any incident of diversity without fear of repercussion. Effective teams, really when we look at both diversity and as we're promoting the innovation, being able to have the team-based approach and having the team, all members having a voice in that team, a very flat structure in and among that. A lot of times in corporations, I think there's an an easy way, and especially for people of color or women, to get lost in a large organization. And yet, if we have good reporting structures and we have good team leadership, and we're able to really highlight that voice and be intentional about allowing women or people of color to be making presentations, to make sure if there is a panel discussion from your team that they are represented to the larger organization. I would also say that onboarding matters. Being able to hire in pods rather than a one-off also gives employees kind of this sense of likeness. So if I'm coming in as a new hire and I'm the only one and I happen to be in a minority, there's a little bit more of a hurdle to overcome to insert myself into the culture. As we're hiring in pods, one, there's an economic gain to do so, because the cost is driven down, but it also supports this idea that when you bring people on and they can go through in cohorts and in pods, then it doesn't highlight as much if I am a person in a minority group. The other thing in this is expressing gratitude intentionally. Gratitude seems like such a funny thing to be talking about as we're talking about innovation and diversity, but studies are being done and are coming to the forefront that simply having a culture of gratitude where we intentionally thank the people that are on our team actually foster this idea of innovation and just appreciativeness among everyone. And then the other thing that I think we need to be looking to industry to do is really benchmark against the best. There are programs, and I think that those have been highlighted in the work that's being done at INVO at the academic level, that companies need to be gathering this information. It's there on all other things that they're doing. They're collecting, they're setting goals, and then they're benchmarking against those goals. And so I think it's important that companies dedicate resourcing, that this is their job to stay current on trends, resources, and developments so that they're bringing that down into the organization, and then constantly creating visibility, highlighting achievements, and letting people see that. So where do we go next, and what else is needed? And I think the big question in all of this is that as we foster diverse innovation in industry, there's still one nagging question, and that is one of ownership. And so as we're aware, the default rule is the inventor owns the patent rights. But in industry, that really hasn't been how it's played out at all. And there are a lot of protections that companies are doing that as an employee, as I'm doing invention, that companies are able to retain ownership. And I ran across a study, it's an older study from a paper from Harvard in 1999, and I included it in the footnotes. But there's a lot of economic pressures for companies to not share the ownership of the patents and the inventions. And to do so, they have a lot of tools at their disposal: pre-invention assignment, work for hire doctrine, and shop rights. And those have various amounts of control that they share with the employees. So Cedric, I would be interested in knowing what the IPTO in the toolkit, what they're gonna do to kind of balance this idea of the economic pressures that companies have in terms of creating and maintaining control of any invention that comes out of their company to be able to make it profitable, but then also balancing that to fully represent the people that were working on it. And so I think that's an area that the IPTO could address and bring great value in creating a solution within the law that allows both of those things to coexist, retain control so that we can maximize profitability on the invention, and yet also do it in a way that we're recognizing all of the efforts that are put in by the people. And historically, that hasn't been something that we've found a really easy balance to have in all of that. And so I do have some additional reading in here, some links to things that we want to, if you want to dig into this anymore. And I would just close with, you know, imagination is more important than knowledge, a famous quote by Albert Einstein. And I think as we're approaching this and this new culture that we want to bring and we want to be more inclusive, that we do need to open up our imagination and look for solution-based solutions rather than feeling like we have to stay within the confines that we currently have. So Holly, I'll turn it over to you to open up Q&A.
Great, thank you. We do have a couple of questions here for you all. Let's start with, I think this applies to all of you probably. Have you done a diversity immigrant entrepreneurs directory? If so, where would that be located?
I can comment in terms of, I'm not aware of such a directory. I am not affiliated with a particular institution. And so I may not be, I may be a bit too removed. You know, I would assume that maybe particular institutions have created such a directory for the people within their institution. But that's as far as I would assume it would go. In terms of, especially in terms of data collection, it could be a challenge, as we've made mention before, of trying to gather such information, especially across an entire organization such as the USPTO or at Autumn in particular. So while I think it is a good idea, there may be some issues associated with trying to get that information together or gathered.
Thanks, Cedric.
Sure.
The next question was for Isabella. So this looks like a great program. How is it different or similar to the federal I-Corps program?
Yeah, I mentioned this a little bit earlier in my speech, but yeah, we use, as I said, we have a person on our team now who is going through that training to be a mentor. So she's using a lot of the same toolkits and resources from that program to help with this. And it's just more of a, let's just call it a university I-Corps program that helps prepare vendors for that program if that's a route they want to take. So we do model our instruction off of the I-Corps program.
Thank you. This one I think was for Cedric. The USPTO toolkit, was that something that was going to be linked in the slides we're sending out? Could you remind me?
Okay, yeah. Whether the toolkit, the IP toolkit that the USPTO made mention of, right,
yep.
Holly?
Yep.
Okay, yeah.
Yep.
As far as I know, I couldn't find any information regarding it. It was pretty easy to find information about the council. I'm already aware of it, stuff like that. And also they talked about it in the My USPTO, their website information. But I have yet to see anything particular about the IP toolkit. I mean, it could be something that the council addresses. And so I responded to the question and answer accordingly. And, you know, we have a council member. We also have Megan, who's on the working group. So that would be great to ask that of them. So Megan already chatted with me that yes, it is. It's specific to women inventors and is online. So I am wrong. And so great to have Megan on the call and be able to answer that question and correct my incorrect information.
Yeah, thank you, Megan. Megan will share it. I'm not sure if Megan can share it with everybody or just with the panelists, but we'll share it out with everybody if you can only share it with us, Megan. I appreciate you with that. Let's see. Next question for Isabella. How did your organization work with women innovators to overcome the other hurdles they might face when it comes to commercializing?
Yes, maybe a little more clarity on exactly what hurdles you're talking about. I know our program, we like to focus not only on the professional hurdles you're going to go through, but also the personal hurdles of raising a family, you know, having a lab, having students, you know, being, it's, you know, as you know, the culture, you know, if you're a woman that's bossy, you're, you know, the bad word. So it's, we try to navigate women that you can still be a nice, genuine woman and still be a leader and still show your confidence. So we lead a lot of personal lessons as well too when it comes to handling. Because I mean, one question we get a lot is, you know, women in the university space, they say, I have my career first before family. It's either they do the research lab and start a lab and do vendors, or they have a family. It's a big struggle they have. And, you know, they always feel like one or the other has to be first and one has to be neglected. So we try to show them different resources, different people that have done both and have been successful in both and provide advice for that. And so we really try to navigate from both personal and professional life hurdles and provide that aspect to the women in our program. If that's what you guys are meaning by other hurdles, hopefully.
And Holly, if I can add to that, just from kind of the company aspect as well, I do think mentorship is key to success in all of this. And really this whole person mentorship, which I think is a newer concept of being able to do exactly what Isabella was just talking about, creating these safe spaces where women can go and discuss real life and the balances that they're trying to do. I think one thing that's come out of COVID is we realize that we all have lives that are happening in our homes and we've started to integrate that. But I would encourage mentorship and a formal mentorship program within organizations.
Yeah, and I want to add actually one more thing. The university has these coffee talks within the university for women in this in the different departments. And it's open for any faculty or student or PhD, or anyone that's in, they, it's a coffee talk. And it's actually very successful where women, like mentors come in and they just say, open the room. What do you want to talk about? And usually there's like that one, and everyone's always too shy to talk about the personal problems, but they really dig in and ask us the personal questions you guys have. And it actually, like these programs have been so successful, like 40, 50 women have been in these programs. And every time I go, I always leave so motivated. And I just love when you can talk to other women about these problems, not have, like you said, kind of to have a safe space.
Thank you. The person who asked the question said that was it. Thank you. let's see. We have one for Tanya. While highlighting effective tactics are key, how do you propose we engage executives into accepting these practices and making them the norm rather than the exception? If our executive office does not represent or embrace diversity, why should the rest of the country?
I think it's a really good question. And my answer is, I think that there's going to become a point in time where the companies are not going to be successful, right? So the executive office needs to be tuned into this because they're going to lose a competitive edge if they don't start embracing these efforts and promoting them forward. We looked at the 2018 study. It's showing the economic impact that comes out of this. But also I think that there's a cultural impact that I think we're even seeing within our law firms that consumers are requiring diversity and they want to know what the diversity efforts are. And so I would say, you know, if anybody has a voice into executive roundtables, executive networking, any of that, you need to be looking at your agendas for the year of speakers you're bringing in. And if you are not directly addressing this, we're just really missing the mark.
Thank you. Let's see. I'm not seeing any other questions coming in at this time. Let's see. Did any of you, Tanya, Isabella, Cedric, any of you have any parting thoughts or, you know, final words?
I'll jump in there. Yeah. You know, I think we are looking at something that is in motion, especially when it comes to the council, and they had their first meeting in September. And so they're getting started and, you know, they're taking action and they're moving forward on things. And so we're looking at a work in progress. And I think we're looking at very early on in that, you know, you're getting information about collecting data. I think in the years to come, we'll probably see more in terms of policies, procedures, programming, additional initiatives to move forward in minimizing this gap. And so I know that some tech transfer offices have reached out and said, well, how do I collect this information for my institution and things of that nature? Well, you know, there's no, you know, right way of doing this. There's some, each organization is different and each has different strengths and weaknesses. And, you know, it may have opportunities to get the information through your HR department. You may not. And so being able to gather that information can be a challenge or it could be straightforward. And so even just gathering the information and then analyzing it and then applying it to your particular institution is a lot to do. And, you know, we're just getting started in that process.
Yeah, and I'm going to add to that too. As, you know, we were mentioning mentorship is really a big deal. I think, you know, as I deal with women in the early set of their career for the most part, mentorship is huge in the sense that they don't know how to reach out or when to reach out. They're too scared that you're too busy, you're too this. I would suggest if you want to be a mentor for women, and you can be, anyone can be, honestly, we don't need just women mentors. We love hearing the guy perspectives too. It's some of the most successful women I actually know, they said that their mentors were, you know, older guys, and they just said that those guys have provided a lot of perspective and advice. But I would suggest in the mentorship, really reach out to women and be there, like to stay with them, connect with them, stay with them. Because a lot of times we see people that want to be mentors and they don't stick with them and they're too busy. I think that's very crucial for a woman in her early stages of career, is relying on that mentorship. And I just think we don't know how, we as women, we don't want to burden people. So be the other side and reach out. And I think that's going to change a lot of things too, and really open up a lot of channels for people and connections.
Yeah, and I would say that across the board for anybody emerging in their career, especially for women, to be able to have that. And I think it needs to come from the employer perspective, that you're going to get a lot more out of your employees. You're going to get a lot further in your efforts if you provide the resourcing for your emerging leaders within your company that are early on in their career.
Thank you. I've got one more question, if you don't mind. Let's address it before we, I just said parting thoughts, but let's do this one more question. Do you think that including diversity information into the USPTO system bears the risk to incorporating racism or other discrimination?
Yes, and I think some of the recent studies were explicit in that. I can't remember which one. It was one of the two that the USPTO cited as part of the Success Act report regarding women and gender rates. It gave a list of recommendations near the end of one of those papers. Sorry, I can't remember which one though. And it did explicitly state that a concern would be to not provide that information to the examiner because there may be some bias associated with the examiner having that information. I do think that doing something where the information is separated from the applications, you know, not included on, say, the application data sheet or something that is provided to the examiner. But I do think that there's a benefit to the information being provided or collected for each application. I do know that that's going to be quite a challenge, given some of the privacy laws that are out there, especially GDPR, which you've already mentioned before. But I think it's very important that the USPTO gets a full picture of its inventor group, and doing it under a voluntary basis, even if you incentivize it, could lead to some other forms of bias in terms of who reports and who does not. So I think there's issues all around. And so navigating it is probably going to take some time and would probably benefit a lot from action by Congress.
I also wanted to add one thing. I have.
Thank you so much. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Isabella.
I had a few questions about this, about how Northwestern collects data. We're not allowed to collect data regarding if their sex, if they're female or male. The Office of Diversity and Inclusion won't let us, which makes sense, you know. So we, on our disclosure, all we really can ask is, you know, their name, their email, the department they're with. But so that's the only way we're able to collect data in that way. So it's really hard when you have a lot of vendors that because a lot of times you only meet with the PI. So we kind of know at that point who they are. But a lot of times they have students that, you know, in terms of their name could be bold. So that's the issue that we're trying to figure out how to collect data the best way. So our numbers are going to be a little inaccurate. So if you guys have any hacks, any ways to collect data that we're allowed to obtain for getting better numbers, I would love to hear your input and your strategies for that, because that's something we are struggling with on how to collect data.
Thank you. I think with that, I'll go ahead and close this out. So on behalf of Autumn, I want to thank Isabella, Tanya, and Cedric for this really good discussion. I also want to thank all of you who attended today. We hope you found some really good information. Just a reminder, a recording of this webinar will be available for viewing within just a day or two of today's event. You'll be able to access that through the My Autumn section of the website or through your Autumn Learning Center. You'll also have access to a PDF of today's slides that is included with your registration. You can also, through the Autumn website, view any past recordings that you might have missed. When you close out of this window, a webinar evaluation will pop up. We'd really appreciate it if you could fill that out. It helps us serve your needs in the future. And with that, I will conclude today's program. Thanks for joining us and enjoy the rest of the day.
Thank you, Holly. Truly appreciate it.